Hello, Legion Cover, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is Hungarian for if it's a goose, it should be fat. Meaning, if you are doing something, you should experience it to the fullest, just like Sebastian Vettel. I'm Drew Scanlon, joining me, Danny O'Dwyer. How are you, Danny?
I'm doing good. I am reporting live from Ireland, which is my audio sounds like this. We're still in the 80s in terms of technology, so I am communicating through the time zone. Also, my throat is very sore today, although it doesn't seem to be COVID, which is great because I was at a wedding last weekend. I'm quite scared. I can't watch races at European times anymore. It's a nightmare. I woke up and I was like, why is the race not on already? I have to wait until after lunch? What?
Also joining us, Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Pretty good. Yeah, I couldn't handle that. Like, F1, I don't like it when they have the race starts delayed to be in the afternoon, because for me, it's like, no, I wake up and we go racing. Right. I can't fathom what it would be like to live in a market where like F1 races are happening in prime time.
If you are new to this podcast, a very warm welcome to you. And if you are new to Formula One itself, we recommend listening to our preseason primer episode in prime time. It assumes no prior F1 knowledge and explains how the sport works and who everybody is. So if you'd like to go back and listen to that, it's episode 178. Also, this show is supported entirely by our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release bonus podcasts and videos exclusively for our patrons that cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with the racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you'd like to support the show and get access to all of that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1. Or click the link in the show notes. What's going on this month, Danny?
It seems like our Discord has sort of American racing fever, because we did American Graffiti last month, and there has been requests from the Discord for us to do Le Mans, the sort of famous early 70s Steve McQueen fictional movie about the real race. So we're going to do that this month. We're going to record it once I get back from Ireland after the break. And we'll add it to our really just expansive repertoire of movie reviews, racing movie reviews, everything from French art house movies to Pixar classics. And none of this, of course, would be possible without our terrific patrons. Everyone wants to be like Mike at Team Blackjack, Michael Maves, Gordy's Army, At Talking Autos, Tanner McCleave, Olivia Evans, Pyrites Card Castle, Erica Siegel, Iron Station Studios, Alan McCrary, telemetrydeck.com, gnarly_goats. I don't say the underscore most times. This time I'm just going to say it. gnarly_goat. David Mule, Drew Stewart, Bailey Foote, The Crew, Abdullah Althani. The title sponsor now known as Jason... Or sorry. The title sponsor now known as Jack Chadwick. Sorry, I've heard your name so many times, the old one, that I said... It was like a reflex.
It's passed into those, like, they're not two names. It's just one, like, Jason Chadwick. Just
yeah,
one
exactly. Yeah, it's exactly. It's yep. One key on the keyboard.
When the host of a game show describes the rules. It's just like one giant word.
Exactly. Yeah, your brain just pulls out that one little. It's right at the end of part of your brain. So are these terrific names: Abraham Getchell, Octo Thorpe, Bunny Crimes, Sniggs, Alex Goucher, Max Voltar, Circuit Demon, Troy Stammer, Umberto Roca, William Rumpf, Wiley Obatong, and Jason. Not Jack, Jason Kelly. Thank you all.
Fantastic. Yes, thank you to all of our patrons who are helping us do this very packed episode. Let's get right to it. We have so much to cover. The grid, everyone. The grid. A digital frontier. George Russell is out ahead on the vanguard of this frontier. His first pole position in, like, such a crazy qualifying session. None of his sectors were fastest, but he somehow got the fastest time. Carlos Sainz in second crushed the first sector, and then something happened in the middle to lose him 0.2. He slots in second place. Then Charles Leclerc in third, Lando Norris in fourth, Esteban Ocon in fifth, followed by his teammate Fernando Alonso in sixth. Then we've got Lewis Hamilton in seventh, Valtteri Bottas in eighth. Way to go, Alfa Romeo. Daniel Ricciardo in ninth. And there's Max Verstappen in 10th. He had an MGUK failure, the motor generator unit kinetic. So he was not able to harvest all that kinetic energy into battery juice. He'll start 10th. Sergio Perez, his teammate, in 11th. Zhou Guanyu in 12th. Then we've got Kevin Magnussen in 13th. Lance Stroll in 14th. Mick Schumacher in 15th. Then Tsunoda, Albon, Vettel, Latifi, and Gasly, who was required to start from the pit lane after his car was modified for additional power unit elements. We've got kind of a mixed bag here on the tires that everyone is starting on.
Yeah.
I'll just mention the top 10 here. Everyone's on mediums, but four. George Russell in first place is starting on softs. Lando Norris in fourth is on softs. Then Daniel Ricciardo and Max Verstappen in ninth and 10th also on softs. All eyes on Verstappen to see how well he can make it through the field, him being very out of position for what we think his car is capable of. So with that, Danny, can you take us through the start?
Yeah, the other person who's kind of out of position here, although there's actually quite a few, but the other one to look at is Russell and how quickly those charging Ferraris behind him are going to be able to perhaps even work together to get around him. But as it happens, when the lights go out, the track is fairly dry at that stage. We had a sort of a couple of wet races with F2 and F3, which were all over the place, but it had dried out pretty thoroughly by the time the lights went out. Russell had a good start. He sort of defended early and well down that straight. Into the first turn, he had it covered off. We had signs
covered
in the
off hard.
He did.
I was curious just your reaction to that. Because, like, you could argue maybe this race hinges on that moment, too, where because the Ferraris can't dispatch Russell, that defense on signs, he was like, you can either go off.
Nope.
Yeah, or you can go into me.
And he kind of forces him to go on the side. He forces him to, like, go in front of Leclerc almost, right? The side where he doesn't really want to try and be too risky. And, you know, Sainz isn't silly, I don't think. I don't think he gets into, you know, crashes. He doesn't Perez himself, you know what I mean? He doesn't get a crash on the first lap over something that he'll get later in the race. And as a result, because, like you said, George sort of, like, defends pretty hard, Carlos kind of has to go to the other side and then keeps second, but doesn't try and push it. While in the background, we've had a decent amount of movement. Hamilton had a terrific start. He was fighting with Lando Norris, who was, I think, three places ahead of him at the start of the race. He actually gets pushed off slightly wide. No one's really at fault here. Hamilton gets pushed wide because Lando goes to the edge of the exit of turn one. Hamilton keeps the position, doesn't gain a position, so nothing said of it. And the only other thing that happened here was that there was a spin. Was this when Tsunoda lost his front wing? I forget where the first spin was that made all that debris happen on the track. It was like a couple of turns in, I think, on his first lap, wasn't it?
It was Albon,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So,
yes.
Yeah, so Albon hit somebody. I can't remember who, or was hit by somebody. But yeah, it triggers the brief VSC. The other thing I'll call out here, and I don't know, not to overly read tea leaves, since the second half of our show is going to be all about this, but Alonso was having what I can only describe as a tantrum on the radio. In the first corners, being like, I've never seen in my whole career anyone defend like Ocon. And I'm looking at the footage, like we have Alonso's in car, and I'm like, bro, what are you talking about? Like it's the start of the race. Like everybody is sort of ducking around to negotiate the traffic. Like I didn't see anything that indicated that Esteban was doing anything particularly like aggressive in terms of defense. I also didn't see anything that looked like much of a real passing opportunity from Fernando. So like it was, and they were into each other the entire race.
Am I wrong, or was this fight like a lion? Wasn't that 2021 in Hungaroring?
Yeah, what happened to that? Yeah. Last year, it's like He's his noble squire, helping Sir Fernando fight his battles, and now it's just like literally it's like a meme. Like it's Ocon just existing on the track, and Alonso being like, "Fuck this guy, I hate this kid."
It's almost like, you know, something that no one else does. That's who his teammate will be next year.
He knows he wants the divorce, but he's just like, I gotta feel like the good guy in all this. Look at all the wrongs that were done me.
Verstappen also makes up two places on the first lap to eighth spot, and over the next few laps, gets by Alonso on lap five after Alonso has a wobble coming out of turn three, and then Ocon with a dive down the inside at turn one on lap seven. Just behind Perez. Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, can I quick note to Russell, who once again managed to, during a virtual safety car, create an enormous gap. He's like, he has become the sort of Mario Kart start, you know, thing where you like press the button down early. He made a 2.5 second gap on Carlos Sainz during the virtual safety car.
I saw that. I thought he was going to get a penalty or something. I was like, there's no way he did it again. There's no way he timed it this perfectly to do this. And like, I do think inevitably he's going to get penalized doing one of these like starts. Like he's like, when you're cutting it that fine, like eventually it's going to go wrong, but he appears to just be absolutely deadly on his ability to like
so
game the safety car system.
I just love the idea that he's like secretly been training for this one very specific thing all the way through the offseason, learning where all the sort of like slow and fast corners are.
In like 10 years, there's going to be like a money ball where it turns out that he had like F1 statisticians like doing advanced stats, where it's going to be like Jonah Hill explaining, like, everyone knows about late braking. Everyone breaks late course. Now.
It sounds like Ken Jennings on Jeopardy being so good, not only because he knew the right answers, but mostly because he had nailed the buzz in, you know.
Right.
Just behind Verstappen, Perez gets by Alonso with, I think, my favorite pass on this track is the outside of turn two. I love it when it feels like you're on a knife's edge the whole time, and when people can get it done, it's
really three impressive. Is right there. So the entire thing turns into just like a side by side, like no room for error, everything hanging in the balance. For all that this track is like, it's very difficult to pass here, the DRS zone turn one through two into three generates more action than we see at most tracks. Like it's like Hungary has its issues, but that sequence generates a ton of action.
By lap 12, a train has formed behind Lando Norris with Hamilton and Verstappen close behind. Hamilton moves first, diving down the inside at turn one, leaving the door open for Verstappen to follow into fifth place as they reach turn two. Lap 15, this is a fun little action here. We get a box pit call from Sainz, which may or may not have scared Mercedes into pitting Russell from the lead. So the undercut, which I'll define in a second, is extremely powerful here, as we'll see a bit later. So, you know, maybe this is Mercedes taking the conservative move and covering it off.
Yeah, it's a short lap here.
Yeah. The undercut is when you you pit from behind your rival, go on to new tires sooner, so that when you come out, you're going faster on your new tires than they are on their old tires, so that when they pit, they've lost time to you and they come up behind you. So Russell pits, Sainz stays out. Russell has a slow pit stop and has to fight his way back onto the track with Alonso through one and two, but keeps it ahead. Meanwhile, Verstappen, sitting in fifth, also pits here, goes from soft to mediums and comes out in eighth place. Sainz then pits a lap later. He also has a slow stop and comes out in sixth behind Russell and Ocon, who hasn't pitted. So nothing really gained there from Sainz.
That's also where Leclerc moves ahead, right? Like that's like this is where a swap basically happens.
So Leclerc assumes the lead. He doesn't pit for a little while longer. Which I'll get to. But Hamilton here pits 3 laps after Verstappen, comes out behind him, ending up in 5th place after the Alpine's pit. So Verstappen utilized his new tires to go faster than Hamilton on track, and he assumes 4th. So he effectively jumps Hamilton with an undercut strategy. So on lap 21, this is when Leclerc pits from 1st place and goes onto the medium tire from another set of medium tires. So he's going to have to stop again. He comes out in 2nd behind Russell and effectively jumps his teammate. Though, you know, who knows what could have happened if Sainz had had a good pit stop. You know, they're pretty close when they come out.
And arguably...
I was going to say, arguably,
this is the race, right? Like, if you're taking... So if you say everything hinges on the decision that's going to come later, it is the fact that they do this medium stop, that now they're still... Yes. They still have that obligation to hit the other compound hanging over them. But also, like, later, Ferrari's going to say our pace never looked right this entire race in the cooler weather. I just don't know that I saw that their pace... Like, it seems like Russell's, like, was holding them both up. But, yeah, at this point, it still feels very much like Ferrari are still in the driver's seat of this, is how it feels at the moment. Like, it seems pretty clear that now that Russell's off those softs, Leclerc with that pace and sort of the tire strategy now being even, it's a matter of time.
Yeah, so Leclerc has to get by Russell as soon as he can. And on lap 28, he has closed up right behind him and pounces when Russell has a wobble coming out of turn 1. Leclerc tries the outside of turn 2, but Russell defends well and keeps the lead. So then 2 laps later, Leclerc gets a run on him down the main straight with DRS and makes a great move around the outside of turn 1 to take first. Lap 38 is my next bit here. Verstappen, sitting in 4th, he's behind Sainz and Russell, makes his final stop for more medium tires, coming out in 6th behind Perez. Russell follows a lap later, but as we've said, the undercut is super powerful here. So he comes out not only behind Verstappen, but behind Perez as well.
Wow.
Who conveniently let Verstappen through kind of at the same time. So Leclerc pits here on lap 39, perhaps also feeling vulnerable to Verstappen. And with 31 laps remaining, Ferrari opts to put him on the hard tire. To which Ted Kravitz says, "Wow, that's brave," based on how it's been going for everybody else, in reference to watching the Alpines struggle after Alonso and Ocon pitted for hards on laps 21.
Had Ricardo already had those laps where he looks like he's driving on ice? Also, like, he got in the stroll because basically the car is just skidding in braking zones.
Yeah, like, he apologized to him afterwards because it was just like, I couldn't, there's nothing I could do.
Yeah, I think that was around lap 16.
Yeah, so like, yes. A race worth of data that this tire is just, it is too cold. Nobody can get the tire up to temperature on, because it's not just cold air temp, there's no sun, and they're keeping these little spatters of rain, so like the grip level never seems great either. The hard just doesn't work that day. And this is the thing I keep coming back to. It's not that Ferrari called a strategy that, like, it didn't pan out. This wasn't a strategy. Like, on that day, the thing that was well known by the middle of the race is the hard doesn't work. It's not even clear that it's wearing well. Ferrari's going to prove vividly that it's not. But there's just no evidence that the hard is viable as a tire in terms of pace. So Ferrari are really kind of inventing a, like, they're calling a play that is just like not viable here today. Effectively, it's a 2 compound race, and that they decide in this moment, we're gonna go with that, we're gonna pick that 3rd compound that's unusable today.
Is the problem that because they started on mediums and then swapped to mediums, that they didn't know the hards were as bad as they were when they made the first call, and so by the time the second call came around, it's like, do you put softs on with 30 laps to go, or try and stretch out your mediums longer?
But Danny,
like, I'm not
the
forgiving
thing.
Them, but like,
yeah, but the thing is, like, they were, so if you're doing medium, remember, the first stint is always going to be the car's going to be loaded with fuel. You are going to get the least distance on those starting tires that you will get throughout the day. I think the second stint might have actually been shorter than the first stint on the mediums.
Really?
So they're not even spacing it out correctly, because if anything, like, the mediums should just be going further anyway. Like, this is such a panic call in response to Verstappen, who admittedly, because of that duel with Russell, I think it had closed up to like 7 seconds when Max went into the pits. So, like, yes, that comfortable Ferrari lead was gone. But, like, in reacting to Verstappen, they also basically set the medium part of the strategy on fire, because it only makes any sense at all if that second stint goes as long or longer than the first. Like, they were kind of locked in to a finish on softs. It was just like there was not an option here. But I think what's going on here is that fucking brain disease you get when you're in first place. Like, track position is, like, I think
like it's sunk still cost bad fallacy for F1 teams.
Yeah, like, the minute, and they don't, and it's worse than any other position. The minute you're in that race lead, you start thinking, like, well, what if we just never pit? What if we just stayed in first the rest of the race? Maybe this hard tire, maybe this piece of garbage could enable us to stay in the lead. And, you know, if Max is going to win this race, he's got to pass us. And if we just stay out there, maybe that never happens.
Yeah, well, as it happens, it doesn't take long for Verstappen to chase down Leclerc. On lap 41, he dives down the inside of turn one to take third, and the effective race lead, since Sainz and Hamilton ahead and first and second have yet to make their final stops. It's a great move, by the way. Verstappen getting squeezed by Leclerc and running close to the grass, then gets it stopped from very high speed without locking up into that turn one. And at this point, the only thing that can stop Max Verstappen is Max Verstappen, which looks like it might happen, as just after he passes Leclerc, he spins on the penultimate corner and Leclerc takes the place back. Martin Brundle saying he thought it might have been water on the track, and we were getting reports of light rain kind of intermittently throughout the race, which, oh man, a wet Hungary is a fun time.
Yeah, it was a funny place to do it. It's one of those it's like easily the slowest, you're coming out of the slowest corner on the entire track. It's like that little corkscrew, the penultimate corner is a nothing. It's like that one in the middle of Bahrain. It's just you just got to get down to the third gear and get through it. So it just seemed like such a weird place to do it. Like,
he got on the radio too, and I think he said he wasn't even on throttle. And so it's not like torque got him. It's just there may have been enough race and like an oily racing surface that it went out from under him. And it still doesn't matter. Like, first of all, the spin, like, he controls it beautifully. He basically goes around once and is still oriented the right way. But then too, on TV, you can visually see that Leclerc's car has just been like kneecapped at this point. Like, the corner exits look so bad. Like, he is like imploring that thing to turn, and then he is having to fully straighten the car out before slowly getting back up, like building power back up. Everyone else can start like applying power through the corner on exit, and the Ferrari is just like shedding time every corner. It's done. It's the clearest illustration of, like, you put someone on a bad tire strategy, this is what happens. This is like an exaggerated version of those dynamics that like cause someone's track position and like pace to completely collapse.
And you can see just how like dramatic it is when Verstappen overtakes him the second time, because it's nowhere near as difficult as it was first time around.
Yeah, and it's It doesn't impact Verstappen as much as it impacts Perez, who is just behind and has to slow down for this, which allows Russell to jump him for fifth place. But by lap 45, Leclerc's hard tires still aren't working, and Verstappen closes back up. Leclerc defends the inside of turn one, and Verstappen, doing the cutback, slides up the inside of the exit of turn one and pulls ahead down into turn two, which is that little section is the second part of the DRS zone. Which is, it's just interesting to watch this because you can kind of see why it exists, because moves that get made into turn one could very easily just get retaken into turn two. And so, but with that DRS, it kind of seals the deal.
Yeah.
So lap 54 with Leclerc going nowhere on his hard tires, Russell gets around him into turn one with the help of DRS. And as Leclerc is probably set to be gobbled up by everyone else behind him, Ferrari opt to bring him in for soft tires to stop the bleeding 15 laps after he had switched to hards.
Yikes.
He comes out in sixth place, which is where he finishes. Ferrari team principal Mattia Binotto, after the race, said in this quote from Autosport, "When we fitted for the hard, our simulation was that it could have been a difficult couple of laps of warm-up. It would have been slower to the medium for 10 to 11 laps, and then it would have come back and had been faster than at the end of the stint. And it was a 30-lap stint. We were trying to protect the position to Max. It would have been too long, certainly, for the softs. Yes, it would have been difficult at the start of the stint, but it would have come back by the end." Leclerc said after the race that he had wanted to hold on to the medium tires for as long as possible, only to be called in for the hards, and asked if Ferrari had seen what Alpine's hard struggles had been and considered not pitting to cover Verstappen. Binotto replied, "Yes, we discussed it. So it's not that the strategy's all written in stone. We took all considerations. We discussed what could have been best. And that's the choice that we made. It certainly was not the right one today."
Yeah, we still made the wrong. It's just, it's, I think, one of the more unfortunate things for Ferrari's strategy calls this year have been that, like, a lot of the time they have seemed, and granted, I understand that, like, viewing the sort of entire race with commentators and strategists often gives you sort of, you know, more information or maybe stronger opinions on certain things. But this isn't the first time that we've been looking at a strategy call from Ferrari that has seemed so outside of the realms of logical that and then at the end has proven to be so. So, like, even not considering how this is affecting Leclerc and how it's affecting their points tallies and everything else, just from an optics perspective, they look so sloppy. And, like, that is not what Ferrari wants to look like in F1. I'd say the break can't come soon enough for them.
Yeah, he closes saying, Binotto does, saying, "Overall, the speed today was not great enough. And whatever tires we were using, I don't think we were as good as we were looking for."
Mm-hmm. So, like, I get that. So, like, the defense that our pace was just off and, like, the race win is probably not in the cards. That may be true. You know, like, Sainz didn't have a strategy go that horribly awry and still, like, the Mercs got him. Like, there were clearly the Ferrari was worse on Sunday than it was on Saturday. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was thinking about this in terms of, like, Ferrari, I don't think, have any sort of general strategic principle that they follow. And so I think when they approach, when they find themselves confronted with, like, the sort of dilemmas that emerge during a Formula One race, I don't think, like, I think one of the things that makes them so volatile is it's just completely unpredictable what you're going to get. Are you going to get a team that freezes and, like, is struggling to look at data at a moment where you need to just be reacting, like you saw at Silverstone, where it's like there's going to be a safety car. You need to get in for the pit. Or are you going to get this hyper-reactive Ferrari that is just, like, desperately reaching for a strategy at a clutch moment in a race and sort of readily shredding the planet brought into the battle? And I was thinking about, like, if you look at how they're two rivals, the two teams they're up against, Opera, and I sort of gotten this in a piece of advice, Red Bull is the Max Verstappen show. And for better and worse, they tend to... Remember Christian Horner said years ago about Alex Albon, "We want our drivers to be heroes."
Yeah.
And their guiding principle is, we are going to call aggressive races and we are going to put... you know, the race in our driver's hand for him to go and get it done, and we trust that he will.
They're very proactive with their, like, decision making. All right, yeah.
And they don't, and they do not particularly value track position in a lot of these situations, because the thing they bet on is, you know, if we get it close, Max will do the rest. Mercedes is basically, they want their drivers to plug into the machine, right? That like, okay, we've got our models, we've got a really reliable car, we can produce really steady pace. And then Hamilton is a good enough driver that he can maintain that pace and the longevity of a stint past the point of what seems like it should be possible. And that's how we call our races, is we just like let the machine run. It can frustrate the shit out of Hamilton, but like in general, they like put trust in the notion that we can predict almost down to like the hundredths of the seconds what our car is going to be doing there on track. And we're just going to call the race based on that. Ferrari do not seem like they trust their drivers. They do not involve their drivers in strategy. We see that with signs all the time being like, what are you doing? What are you telling me? Are sort of debating it with them. And I just think this defense from Binotto is really revealing, where it's like, you know, we sort of had data that suggested like the tire could work. And also like the race was probably lost anyway, because the pace was off. I don't know. You got arguably like one of the strongest driver lineups on the grid. I would say this is one of those days where it's like, boy, it's time to go earn your paycheck, right? That's what Red Bull would do, regardless of what the pure pace of the car is. There's an important interface element in it, and you're gonna have to, you know, you sort of need to trust that at some point. We know Charles can fight Max. And they don't do that. And so that's as close as I can come to like a theory of what's ailing Ferrari. Is just, it's the way this lack of like bad results worsen a crisis of confidence and make it even harder to build any kind of identity, because whatever you do seems to be wrong.
Yeah, it's interesting to contrast that with Red Bull. Like, as you say, Danny, they seem very proactive. They seem like they're just running their own race and everyone else is just like reacting to it. After the race, Max Verstappen actually praised his strategist specifically. He said, "Today, I think Hannah, our strategist, was insanely calm. Yeah, she's very good." And this is, he's referring to Hannah Schmitz, Red Bull's strategist. And I think that's insanely calm is what I get from Red Bull's strategy, right? Like, yes, they make mistakes, but it's more like it's not, they never seem harried. They never seem like, except when they're, you know, when they don't have Daniel Ricciardo's tires ready in Monaco. but yeah, I think that's a really accurate characterization.
Yeah, Rob, I think his breakdown's really, even with Binotto, what Binotto said at the end is revealing, and that if you could imagine Mercedes or Red Bull, they would be saying like, we need to do better. We did the wrong call. It was on us. You know what I mean? There's a sort of a, I don't know, like a frail or limp sort of, oh, well, our car wouldn't have been fast anyway, which is just like very, that's not the type of energy I necessarily want from the top.
I think there's an element too of Binotto. I think I feel like I remember the story talking about like last year or something, where Binotto is a guy who like straight up refused to fire people on his team because he was like, nobody did anything wrong. We're just having bad
conflict
results.
Diverse.
Well, not just, but I do think here's the thing. I think on balance, I look at Binotto, I'm like, he's done really good things for Ferrari. Like, that engine has major issues, but like the issue it doesn't have anymore is that there's no freaking power, which was true for years. I think like in terms of like, they built a really good car. The thing that is missing right now is either Binotto, the people like Binotto is trusting to like run race strategy and like handle these calls are doing it wrong. And he's just like taking these arrows for them and avoiding being frank about what happened there, or he is in charge of that pit wall. And this is just an aspect of this that he's not good at, which is fine. Like, the big crisis Ferrari had was car development. That seems to be not totally solved, but trending in the right direction. like the thing that's got to change now is however it happens, whoever is running these races, how they're running these races has got to change. And I hope like Binotto's just being circumspect about what's happening as he just like refuses to sort of get into that. The nightmare, the thing that would probably get him fired is if he truly is just going to sit there and be like, well, the data said this, and that's going to be his, like, he's going to go down with that ship. And he will, because you can't, you know, Danny, last week you said Ferrari's kind of in a fight with Red Bull. And that was like borderline, not Red Bull, yeah. Mercedes. And that was borderline true last week. But you're like, they should be able to put this away. Nope. Nope. They are fully now, like, them holding on the second, totally up in the air.
Yeah. This from Autosport headline today, Ferrari sees no need for team changes after recent F1 struggles. So exactly what you were saying, Rob. He's still holding to this. So the only thing at this stage that Verstappen has to fear is his old rival Hamilton, who pitted on lap 51 for soft tires and has been steadily climbing back up on lap 63 of 70. He blitzes Carlos Sainz on the main straight with DRS. And on lap 65, he goes to the outside of turn one on his teammate George Russell, then executes a cutback to pull ahead with DRS into second place. Awesome seeing him fight at the end here, but ultimately Verstappen is too far ahead for Hamilton to catch, winning the race by a margin of nearly 8 seconds. And I did want to point out that Perez also was on a roll, but it was stymied by a late virtual safety car for Bottas, who went out with a technical issue. But the race wraps up like this. Max Verstappen on top, Lewis Hamilton behind in second, and George Russell, another podium for him, in third place. Carlos
Sainz
in fourth.
Same podium as France, right?
I think that's right, yeah. Carlos Sainz in fourth, Sergio Perez in fifth, Charles Leclerc in sixth, Lando Norris seventh, Fernando Alonso eighth, Esteban Ocon ninth. They did a one stop.
Wow.
And Sebastian Vettel somehow got a point in his the race that he is announcing his retirement, 10th place. Behind him, Lance Stroll. Then we got Pierre Gasly, Zhou Guan Yu, Mick Schumacher, Daniel Ricciardo in 15th, Kevin Magnussen, Alex Albon, Nicholas Latifi, Yuki Tsunoda, and Valtteri Bottas, the only DNF. Hamilton also got fastest lap, so he got one extra point.
Yeah, rough race for the McLarens. Even Lando, you know, maybe you could argue he was qualified higher than he thought, but that was probably because of where the Red Bulls were, so, you know. But he was kind of, there was a couple of the drivers you just never saw during this race, and he seemed like he was one of them.
Yeah. Well, heading into the summer break, this is how the championships stack up. Max Verstappen is on top of the Drivers' Championship with 258 points to Charles Leclerc's 178.
Wrap it up.
That is
wrap it up.
80 points, everyone. Sergio Perez is in third with 173. Then we've got George Russell in fourth with 158. Carlos Sainz with 156 in fifth place. Then Lewis Hamilton with 146. Lando Norris with 76. Esteban Ocon with 58. Valtteri Bottas with 46. And Fernando Alonso in 10th with 41. Magnussen has 22. Ricciardo has 19. Gasly and Vettel are tied at 13th place with 16 points. Mick Schumacher's in 15th with 12. Then we've got Tsunoda with 11. Zhou with 5. Stroll with 4. Albon with 3. And Latifi and Hülkenberg with 0. In the constructor standings, Red Bull Racing is on top with 431 points to Ferrari's 334. Mercedes is in third with 304, just 30 points back from Ferrari. And if things keep going this way, that's going to be a close fight. Alpine's in fourth with 99. McLaren's in fifth with 95. Then we've got Alfa Romeo with 51. Gene Haas and team have 34 points. Alfa Tauri's got 27. Aston Martin has 20. And Williams has 3.
Woo!
And with that, let's take it to the news. Oh my God, there is some.
Lots of
after
news.
Like a month or more of kind of nothing. some bombs got dropped this week. Danny, kick things off for us.
Yeah, I guess did we just miss this? Was this on the Thursday of the race weekend?
Like literally, yeah.
Yeah, Sebastian Vettel, at the age of 36, having spent 36 years in F1, pretty much. Guy's been in the sport for about 20 years at least, most of his life. He is retiring. He is done and dusted. There's no news as to what he's doing next. He put out a great little video on Instagram, an interesting sort of a one-shot, his statement. He wrote it out, read it out rather. And I've just taken one paragraph from it, which is sort of the meat and potatoes of it. He said, "I love this sport. It has been central to my life since I can remember. But as much as there is life on track, there is my life off track too. Being a racing driver has never been my sole identity." And the consensus seems to be that this has been a decision that has kind of like happened over a number of years, which I think we also could kind of sense. That his family is growing up, his kids are growing up, the seasons are getting longer, you know, there's more races, he's away more often, he has sort of, in many ways, he is a multiple world champion. Whether or not he can do that at another team will probably require the sort of Herculean effort that maybe somebody at his stage in his career is not willing to put in. And of course, there is a lot of the work that he has been doing off the track in terms of, you know, understanding nature and human impact on it. It's clearly something that he has a passion for, and whether or not that's something he wants to spend more time doing or whether or not there is a conflict between that and his F1 life is perhaps part of that as a decision as well. So it, in many ways, it's shocking because to see, you know, one of the best drivers and one of the most prolific drivers, and in many ways a driver who I still consider to be like kind of young or something, or like not young, but he's not Fernando Alonso, you know, he's not like Michael Schumacher when he was back. He's not Kimi. So to see him retire in one way is shocking, but in another way, sort of similar to Nico Rosberg, it's not like, he did the thing, you know what I mean? And it seems like an incredibly difficult, you know, job to have a life outside of in any respect, be it a parent or have hobbies or be able, like, would you ever go on vacation if you spent your life, your entire year traveling around the world? Like, what is it even like? So, yeah. Happy for him, sad to see him go, and I hope we have him as a presence. He's an incredibly smart guy. Like, he's sharp, he's very German, right? He's very like intelligent and sort of aware of himself and his own emotions and place within the sport. I think he would be really good in some sort of an administrative role or some area of F1, so I hope he's not gone forever, but yeah, kind of sad and happy for him.
Yeah, it's like, I think I'm mostly sad because it has been really terrific in these last few years watching him be one of like the moral leaders of the sport and one of the few that like, you know, it basically, you know, at heart, it's mostly him and Hamilton who seem to be people who really think deeply about like their role in the world, the state of the world, their obligations as citizens and as like stars with a huge platform. And a lot of drivers, that is not their bag. And to an extent, like a lot of drivers are younger. This stuff becomes more your bag maybe as you age into it. But like seeing Vettel emerge as somebody very, very sincerely concerned about, you know, issues like environment and social justice, has been really heartening, having him be someone who forces those conversations on a sport that really goes out of its way to duck them. But I think the thing that I do find, you know, kind of cheering about this is it has been clear for a while that, like, in a lot of ways, Seb is a German dad who, like, wants to. There's an interview he did with Sky ages ago where he talked about, like, he likes to work on his antique motorcycles when he goes home, but, you know, the part I remember is, like, I never get anywhere because I always have to sit there trying to remember a month ago, the last time I had time to do this. Where, what was I trying to do? What was I, where did I leave off? And it was like a story that kind of illustrates just, I think, probably what life feels like with these modern F1 seasons, where it is just like you're always kind of disconnected from home life and what is your life outside F1? What is the structure of the thing? And so I have felt for a while that like he's been right on that border of, is F1 a net positive in my life, or is it just a thing that I'm still doing because it's my career? And so I am curious to see like what the next act for Vettel is, but also would not surprise me if the next act is a real retirement where he is going to be like, I think most athletes are kind of full of it when like they think they're going to go and spend time with, it's all going to be about family and being like retired young. I think most of them, that is not who they are. That's not what they're built for. I think Seb's one of the few I could actually see it if he just disappears into his little pollinator paradise that he's building outside his house.
Yeah, totally. I feel that same way. You could see it with Kimi, and you could see it, well, maybe not this time around, but Nico is another one where you're kind of like, yeah, man, YouTube's where the money's at. Sebastian Vettel can't raise bees if he's disappearing every couple of weeks to go somewhere else. The bees will not be happy. So, yeah. What did you make of it, Drew?
I mean, it was surprising, but it also made a lot of sense. But I will be sad to see him go. He's one of those guys that just the more I see of him, the more I like him. I was not watching Formula One when he was winning all the time, so I don't. I started at a pretty good spot, I guess. I think you're right. I think he's a great ambassador for the sport. It's nice to have someone who he seems like the. Maybe the last of the current drivers, I can't really think of anyone else like this, who like is an F1 nerd. Like there was that time where they asked him to, how many F1 champions can you name? And he named all of them in chronological order.
Yeah, it was wild. Was it Grill the Grid on the F1 YouTube channel? Yeah.
Well, like, I do love that Ricardo called it. He's like, Seb will know all this. He's a nerd. And like 100%, I was like, oh, you know, you're mad, but I guess I didn't. Cause like, it was ridiculous. He could go back to the start of F1.
He when he crashes out in, you know, practice or qualifying or something, you see him on the side of the track looking at other cars. Mm. You know, we've got Inspector Seb, the guy who looks at, you know, close to aerodynamic elements whenever they're lined up, you know, after a session. This weekend he crashed in free practice 3, I think, and they rebuilt his car for qualifying, and he was in there with a freaking wrench, you know, trying to help his team. So that's the kind of guy that I wish there was more of in Formula One. And so I'll be sad to see him go, but best of luck to Seb. He apparently informed his team on Wednesday, the Wednesday before Hungary, that he wanted to retire.
Guy tipping domino meme.
Yeah, pretty much. It sounds like Aston Martin had kind of, maybe not expected, but thought that this could have been a possibility. So they have had contingency plans here. It's understood, so says this Autosport article, that Aston Martin and its owner Lawrence Stroll have been hard at work for several days pulling together a package that was good enough to convince Fernando Alonso to commit without needing to drag things on to the summer break. So Alonso's contract was up this year, and they apparently things were not going well enough for Alonso over at Alpine. So he has signed on for Aston Martin, something that Alpine only discovered when the press release went out.
How am I not surprised? Alonso doesn't seem to care about the formalities of this type of thing, honestly.
He also doesn't seem to care how good the team he's going to is.
No, it's like you've got your Pokemon card book and you're trying to make sure you've driven for every team possible. Or like maybe he's just, I mean, the other part of the Vettel thing we didn't talk about much is kind of just how when he joined there, it was to try and hopefully get in a team that will be fighting at the top. And that's clearly wasn't the case, and this season has been a bit of a nightmare for Aston Martin. I mean, Alonso's basically been doing the same thing. He's been like rolling the dice up against the side of the house, trying to land at a team during any period that is going to rocket him into, you know, into any sort of you know, that even the top of the mid pack, I think he'd be sort of happy with at this stage. And he should have waited out at McLaren, maybe.
He's kind of getting there at Alpine, which is, I think, maybe what makes me a little confused.
Right. Yeah. Like, but you're right. They're on that fight with McLaren. Yeah.
No, it's, but I the think, thing, sorry, Drew, go for it.
I was just going to say, I think the only thing that makes this make sense to me is, well, two things. Either one, Fernando Alonso just loves money and Lawrence Stroll has a lot of it, or he can kind of, you know, prognosticate a little bit and say like, well, if their, you know, hot Formula 2 driver comes in here and I get let go, there might not be another seat after this. You know, he's the oldest driver on the grid. Yes, he's a double world champion, and yes, he is driving the wheels off his Alpine, but like, are other teams going to want that necessarily? Enter Aston Martin, who absolutely wants a championship winning driver in their car. I think it's kind of just something that fits.
Also, Lance Stroll has retired more teammates than just about anyone else in the history of F1. So he's got to add another name to his
absolute
belt.
Like kiss of death. No, it is the thinking around this is a little bit odd to me, and I do feel like, yeah, it might be that Alonso doesn't have a ton of great options. There's been some questions about like how committed is Renault really with this Alpine project. You know, are they still investing what they need to invest in this team to help it be competitive? But also, I do think there's, like, the thread that ties Alonso's career together is that where he goes, the team declines. Or he does not stick around long. But, he goes to places where he feels like he will be set up to succeed, and there is going to be a strong development program that is, like, sort of built around him. And he takes that bet every single time. But also, historically at least, it does not sound like he's ever been somebody to not also try to be general manager of the team a little bit. Like it always feels like he steps into this weird, like, not necessarily management role, but like exercising kind of a weird veto power or supervisory power over the team. Like, Horner made this comment years ago that, like, the, you know, up and down the paddock, it was kind of known that, like, Alonso is a great driver, but be careful what else is coming through the door with him. And I do believe that, because, like, I don't think it's Horner just talking out of turn. I suspect that is true, because there's a lot of evidence compiled around it. And so, like, it makes sense that he, like, this pitch from Aston is exactly the sort of thing he would go for. But I'm also kind of fascinated by the clash of ego that's about to occur, where you're going to have him and Lawrence Stroll and then all these ex-McLaren dudes trying to spin up this new team and set it on a direction. And the boss's son as his teammate. I think this is, like,
it's like Shakespearean, this one.
Yeah, I don't know that it, I don't think that's, like, it's too strong to say it has disaster written all over it, but it does seem like it's very prone to joining the long list of, like, lateral Alonso moves that in retrospect you're like, well, that was awkwardly timed. And maybe it wasn't. Maybe it's just circumstances change around him.
It's like Frogger when you have to go backwards to go forwards, you know? You gotta jump from the log to the, you know, the crocodile to go the opposite direction to get back forward. I don't know. So, but we'll see. I what you were saying about him, like, kind of taking over the team, that seems just ripe to happen at Aston Martin, because, like, do they have a strong leadership? I have no idea. I run a Formula One podcast. I can't tell you the name of their team principal. Can you guys?
Mike Crack,
Lawrence,
right?
Stroll.
Oh, is it Mike Crack?
Isn't he?
That's right. Yeah. Have they talked to... I've never seen them talk to him.
I mean,
on Sky feed. Yeah.
I mean, they're pumping a lot of money into that outfit. There's a lot of... And they were. They have been now for a couple of years. But we have yet to see, you know...
Yeah, I tend to think like this is a program that like Lawrence Stroll is doing his turnaround artist thing too, and he is bought in on sort of the cast of like Ron Dennis castoffs from that period in McLaren and is sort of investing in that. It does seem it seems ripe for like Alonso to really really get Nor in there. Drew, you also alluded to, were you talking about Oscar Piastri, that like he also saw that there's a weird dynamic at Alpine that he was...
Yes.
And that's continued to be weird. So in the middle of all this, there's sort of this, there's the sort of time bomb element, which is that Oscar Piastri is a Formula 2 driver, prodigy, one of the most promising talents, showed up, immediately won the title, and is like one of those guys who in the last year, everyone's saying, like, will be driving an F1 car by 2023. He is a Alpine driver. He came up through the junior program, signed a reserve deal with the team, and has been pushing to get into a racing seat. And Autosport had a good breakdown of sort of the weird dynamic of this, but the problem is Alpine had three great drivers, right? Alonso, Ocon, and then Piastri, and they just got the two cars. And so it seems like they were trying to, it seems like they may have been trying to like push two things. One was loan Piastri out. Send him to a lower tier outfit to gain some F1 experience, like basically do the Ocon or Russell like training program of you're not ready for the big team yet. We're going to have you go cut your teeth with a back marker. Piastri's agent, Mark Webber, does not. And, you know, he himself, I guess, were not sold on that. Like there was rumors. Mark Webber is in the story. And so here's the thing. Apparently, you're pushing hard. Like, we don't want to go to Williams. You know, so if you're not going to give us a seat on Alpine for 2023, apparently there's a rumor that there's already a deal with McLaren. Let me tell you, Norris is not going to be the guy that McLaren is going to be getting rid of. So, again, after weeks of Ricciardo being like, I had a contract for next year. Like, that's it. Like, it's going to be fine. There's a rumor that a lot of people are giving credence to that Mark Webber and Piastri already have a deal, maybe just a handshake, maybe formally signed with McLaren that they're pushing to go through. But... it's like the Pelot thing. Alpine has a contract too. So, like, this is a mess. And it theoretically, like, now Alpine seem like their play is just to be like, well, of course he's going to drive for us. Like, that's going to be what happens here. But it kind of sounds like Webber really wants to put him at McLaren. Which is also kind of weird because, like, I guess I didn't realize, like, is there not a good relationship between the two Aussie drivers? Like, this is a putting Danny Ric in the crosshairs, right? So it's
Weber's place at Red Bull? There was no one else in the middle there, right?
No.
When Webber retired, it was Ricciardo in, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. We need to
Piastri is also Australian.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's getting messy here. We need like a sort of a Judge Judy type show. Maybe Eddie Jordan can be
And it's all with McLaren. It's all with McLaren. McLaren is the fucking Maury Povich show of, like, racing programs. Like, you could do, okay, on this episode, we're going to get to the bottom of this Ricardo contract. The next one, Piastri. And then, like, next time, these four IndyCar drivers all think they're being tapped for an F1 seat. But it turns out that they've already given it away. Like, it's wild what is happening over there.
Yeah. I like the idea of Zach Brown sitting down, surrounded by people in helmets with Maury Povich reading out their what team they're going to be playing for next.
Well, if you'd like to play on our team, the Shift F1 Official Fantasy League, you can join using the link in the show notes. Want to read out the podium from Hungary this week. In third place from America, Tyler's team, Go Go Roscoe. Agreed. Roscoe, all the best to Lewis Hamilton's dog.
Wait, did he pass away or?
No.
Oh, just in general, just Go Go. We love Roscoe.
I just love him. From America, Kyle's team in second place, Hasta La Vista, baby.
Mm.
And speaking of Red Bull, in first place. From Hungary, from Germany, Christian's team, Multi21.
Multi21, Seb. Multi21, speaking of Mark Webber.
Yeah. But overall, here's what the top three look like in the Fantasy League. The Canadian team in third from Jeremy's team. What's first happening to me?
Mm.
In second place from Canada, Michael's team, Leo Speed. And in first place, from America, James's team, Maximum F-Vert 3.
Oh, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. I love it. My dad's joke gland is tingling.
We got there. All right. Let's see. Well, we're about to head into the summer break. So I feel like we should squeeze in an email here before we go. Maya in Sacramento.
Yeah, thanks, Drew. I wanted to squeeze this one out because we were kind of done with the first 13 races of the season, and there's 9 left, so it's not a clean break in the middle. But Maya said she was going to the races in both France and Hungary, and I have trimmed down 2 emails she sent me to just give you the sort of lowdown on how she got on. Hey guys, I mostly recovered from the French Grand Prix and wanted to share some thoughts. I am very glad to hear that F1 likely won't be returning to Paul Ricard. Even with ample trains and shuttles, the track is hard to reach. There was no signage at the track to help fans find their section, and the map included with tickets showed walking paths that were complete dead ends or didn't exist at all. On our way out, we were routed through the support race maintenance area and ended up having to climb through a fence to get out. We only saw one stolen sign, a 50-yard marker being carried out by someone in a staff shirt, but we saw dozens of people leaving with what looked like motor oil canisters. Think kegs with big flammable symbols. We left the track eventually with a group of marshals who had all unzipped their race suits to reveal shirts for their favorite teams. I guess it makes sense that someone who signs up to be a marshal is a pretty intense fan, but it still felt a little bit odd. We sat next to a group of Germans who were hardcore Mick supporters, which was fascinating to see. After Joe's collision with Mick, they started yelling at Joe needed to be banned from the sport. Just wild. They also assumed that as Americans, we must also be Haas fans and therefore Mick fans.
Nice.
Don't even know them.
By comparison, the Hungarian GP was a dream. While the shuttle option was extremely inconvenient, the GP's partnership with the local taxi companies made getting to and from the track fairly convenient. The French GP had a major online presence before the race, while the Hungarian GP didn't update their website until Thursday night before the race weekend. But France was a total mess in person, and Hungary was so attendee-friendly. The Hungaroring had a ton of signage, helpful volunteers everywhere, and tons of food and drink options. I'm also now a firm believer that all rainy sporting events should require to have fresh chimney cakes available for purchase. I never heard of a chimney cake, have you?
Neither have I. I'm just looking them up good. Right now.
Is that a funnel that. Cake?
Is it a funnel
sounds
cake?
Sounds like it.
Yeah, that makes sense. It was also nice attending a race that's relatively close to a city center. Rob mentioned our army presence in last week's episode, so I wanted to give my personal observations on that. First of all, both races were so overwhelmed at the entrances that even hours before quali at the Hungaroring, no one looked in my purse or even scanned my ticket. On race day at Paul Ricard, the guy in front of me in line brought in a full-size duffel bag and security didn't check it. As someone who attends frequent events in stadiums in the US, I was really shocked to see that the bag rules were so relaxed. There wasn't much security presence in the stands. The security guards I saw were watching the race, not the fans. So I'm not sure anything would have stopped Orange Smoke, but I didn't see any in person at all. There was a heavy Orange Army presence at boat races, but I didn't notice reserve stands for them at either. I will say the Hungarian Grand Prix felt like a Max home race, with a minority of those in attendance wearing apparel supporting any other driver or team. As someone who wore McLaren or Mercedes merch throughout the weekend, no one made any inappropriate comments to me, which was a relief. By comparison, the level of French patriotism at the French GP made it seem like Pierre, and to a lesser extent Esteban, were the best drivers in F1. My biggest takeaways are that I would highly recommend attending the Hungarian Grand Prix to anyone interested in attending a European race. For all 3 days, we paid $350 to sit at the end of the pit exit, and we got to witness some great overtaking. And I know this conversation has come up before when listeners write in about wanting to know where to sit at races. And in my recommendation is to absolutely pay for seats and consider what's more important to you. In France, we sat at a hairpin and the cars had to go through very slowly so we could actually recognize who was who, but we didn't get any overtaking. In Hungary, we got great overtaking, but between the race feed on the track screens and the high speed at that DRS zone, we could rarely tell who was driving past us outside the race leaders. My last note, at the French GP, there was a dedicated Pierre Gasly store, and all purchases came with a liked by Pierre Gasly tote, a phrase Pierre has now trademarked per the bags. And now I'm shifting to getting ready. Apparently, liked by Rob Zachney. Let's do it. Now I'm shifting to getting ready to head to IndyCar in Monterey in September. All the best, Maya.
Wow.
All right, so before we
Thank you, Maya.
Hungaroring, let's do it.
Well, actually, before we get to that, Rob, I just wanted to follow up with Chimney Cakes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They do not appear to be related to funnel cakes, because funnel cakes they're not what you would expect. They don't look like a funnel. They look more like spaghetti. But Chimney Cakes do. Chimney Cakes look more like a vertical cannoli.
Oh. Is there anything in them?
Yes. Or like an ice cream cone, but made out of pastry rather than like a waffle. And inside, I don't think it's ice cream. I think it's more like
ice cream. Shit.
Yeah. We should gotta get some of these. Yeah.
Can we get them sent over? Maybe it is ice cream. Like the cans and the wine.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, Rob. Is there some breaking news?
There is. So that whole conversation we had about Piastri, mooted.
What happened? What happened?
He signed.
He signed for who?
Signed with Alpine.
Alpine.
Oh,
nice.
Wow.
So,
okay.
You mean
we actually got the news in our podcast this time?
Wow. It happened finally after 8 years.
Like, literally, as we're talking about that, the Alpine team announced that Ocon and Piastri are going to be driving together next year. So Ricardo looks a little safer for the moment.
Right.
And this odd little, dive for McLaren seems to have been seen off. Which makes a lot of sense. It seemed like with these changes of circumstance, he was an Alpine driver. Yeah, this was probably going to happen.
You need to scroll down on that tweet and look at the replies. There's one here that has Alonso's head replaced by Franklin from Grand Theft Auto 5. And I think it's Otmar Szafnár as his dog.
Oh, my God.
It's something else.
That is incredible.
I don't drift into the F1 meme world all that often, but that was all right. That was all right.
Sorry. This is just a stray thought. But okay. All this mess, I was thinking about the contract thing with Piastri and like what it would be like if Alpine were trying to force it to be honored. Just a quick little check-in on how things are going with IndyCar.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like Pillow and Ganassi are maybe headed to federal court.
Oh, you're kidding.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I guess there might also be like a... There might be a defamation beef because everyone's filing those these days. So it is like... I'll look into that more over the break, and I'm sure stuff will happen. But this is the type of stuff that Alpine probably wanted to avoid. You know, like the Piastri and Alpine camps is like, we have a contract. Let's just get it done. Let's just promote.
There's the outside chance that I was thinking maybe they just did the McLaren thing just to lean on Alpine to announce it. But have you checked that Piastri is like maybe he's over on his Instagram being like, I haven't signed anything. It's just Alpine doing.
That's
like
a great point. I gotta believe it, like especially in this environment now, everyone's being real careful about how these announcements are going. Although I say that, and like Alonso was just out there freelancing this entire thing. You know,
he's the kingmaker. He's like, it's like Game of Thrones, and he's like, I don't know, Tyrion or something.
All right,
he's checking.
Well, out. I'm just stunned here that we actually got to talk about a news that happened. Thanks to Alpine for telling us now.
Excited to see him next year. That's good news overall. Just to see
another great
driver come through as well. So thanks, Seb. Kind of.
If you'd like to stay up to date on the latest breaking news, follow @ShiftF1Podcast, where I retweet news when I see it. So we also are on Twitter ourselves @DrewScanlon, @DannyO'Dwyer, and @RobZachney. That's us around the internet. Should we take it around the world of racing one more time, Danny, before the summer break?
I've never been so excited to do this because I'm in a bedroom. The window's open and my mom is putting clothes out on the line, so she's definitely going to hear this. Let's race around the world. Yeah.
All right. Well, the World Rally Championship is in Finland this weekend in, oh boy,
what prefecture?
Jyväskylä, Finland.
Jyväskylä.
Sure. The NASCAR Xfinity Series is at the Michigan International Race Speedway in Brooklyn.
Huh?
Just confusing. What? For the New Holland.
What?
250. Wait. What state are we in?
What country are we in?
MotoGP is at the Silverstone Circuit for the British Grand Prix. Motocross Grand Prix is at the Glimminge Engine Stadium Uddevalla for the Motocross Grand Prix of
Uddevalla.
Uddevalla. The IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship is at Road America this weekend.
Mm.
For a 2-hour, 40-minute race. IndyCar is at Nashville for the Music City Grand Prix.
Woo!
And Super GT is in the Fuji Speedway in Oyamacho, Suntogun, Shizuoka-ken Prefecture.
Thank you very much. No NASCAR?
Here we got NASCAR.
Oh, we do.
Oh, yeah. Sending where are we at? Road America. The summer sun. No, we're also in Brooklyn.
Oh, in Holland, Michigan. In the Netherlands.
Yep. For the Fire Keepers Casino 400. Keep the fire.
Did you hear the incredibly upsetting news about trucks?
Yes, I did.
People shared that with us. People were like, guys. Yeah.
Devastating.
Camping world
has
decided.
It's
the end of the camping world.
It's the end. Camping world is over. What new world will we find over the horizon?
Listen, this happened a few years ago, okay?
It did.
So they will be back. Just everyone hold on. It's going to be a rough year or so, but don't worry. Everything will be fine.
What is Gander Mansion going to come back? Or?
Oh, that'll be fun.
Oh, that'd be, that, you know so. What? If God if God ends a camping world, but like opens a Gander Mountain, then I think we're all good.
Yes. Best of luck to everyone surviving the summer break with no Formula One. We will be out for 2 weeks, but we will be back the week before the
Spa.
Yes, the Belgian Grand Prix, which I believe is the 24th.
I think, is it?
But yeah, for our episode, it'll be the 24th.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, look ahead to that. If you are looking for things to watch in the off season or enjoy rather, you can listen to our Patreon shows.
Yeah. And
as Danny said, we'll be back later this month with Le Mans.
Yeah. If you do sign up, you get access to like all of the posts. It's not like you have to like wait around for them to accumulate. You get access to like God knows how many podcasts at this stage, a couple of dozen, more, I don't know, 30, 40 probably. I couldn't tell you, but lots of stuff.
Well, we have been doing this for 1,000 years, so.
It has, yeah, way longer than we expected.
Yes. Final thoughts on this first half of the season, Danny.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame. In a way, it does put a pin in Max Verstappen's championship, unless something really ridiculous kind of happens. But lots of interesting fights for the constructors and for second place and kind of second through fifth. They're all kind of packed together there. So, you know, wouldn't be surprised to see Sainz come through or see Hamilton maybe. And you know, because the Mercedes has had a change of form. So, yeah, still looking forward to loads of it. But it definitely I don't think we're getting anywhere close to the championship deciding madness of last year. Maybe for good. My heart still hasn't quite recovered from that one.
Yeah. Final thoughts, Rob.
Yeah, it is a bit disappointing that in a season that's been really dynamic and like there are a lot of cars that are well matched up and down the grid, the way it is shaking out at the front is so lopsided. But you know, this is Red Bull were sort of poised to crush it like this. And the only team that's really as put together in terms of operation is Mercedes, which, you know, these are the two teams who have been here the most recently in terms of like having dynasty periods. And so I guess it should not be that much of a surprise that in the kind of fight we're seeing toward the front, it is getting a little lopsided because Ferrari is a team emerging from a lot of wilderness years. I hope we still get a lot of action in the latter half of the season. I think the battle for the other the other high constructors title positions will be pretty intense. So I think there's a lot to look forward to there, and the stakes are pretty high for a lot of teams in all of this. And also the fact that now we have so many lame duck drivers, it's going to be kind of a weird vibe in terms of like the politics in between like the drivers and teams.
Yeah. Well, 2023 is going to be interesting in the driver market. We've got, Gasly. So here's who's up at the end of 22. Zhou, Tsunoda, Schumacher, Latifi, and Albon, and technically Stroll, LOL. and then in 23, it's Gasly, Ricardo, Hamilton, and then question marks next to these, but Bottas, Piastri, Magnussen, and Russell. So that's a lot. The only ones confirmed past that are Perez, Verstappen, Norris, Leclerc, Sainz, and now Alonso. Oh, and Ocon. So
Ocon, yeah, Ocon has a long-term contract.
Yeah, it's through 2024.
That's interesting. I haven't turned on Ocon, but I also haven't seen the like. Yep, that potential is fully being paid off. Thing. No. So I. It is a good thing for him he has that contract, I think, because I suspect that if they like Piastri's now their sort of like young driver of the future.
Yeah.
So he's got a, he's really going to have to like show some stuff in the next few years. Cause I got to believe like if he would be a top candidate to be replaced.
But also definitely guys. Like, I feel like Alonso leaving also gives Ocon a little bit of breathing room because they're, you know, they're, you know, it's close there as well.
Well, and
he doesn't go with the name.
Hey, no more like looking after Alonso's feelings as far as like team orders. Like you can race that guy as hard as you want. Fuck him. Like that's
I think
Omar has a little bit of that dog in him, where it's like just the way this was handled. Like, I think Alonso could be like, I think Alonso can look forward to a vibe shift at Alpine.
Also up in 2023, the contract of Toto Wolff at Mercedes. We shall see next year, and we will see how things wrap up this year when we come back in 1, 2, 3 weeks time. So until then, if you'd like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes and the official Shift F1 Discord, you can do so over at patreon.com/shiftf1. Have a good summer break, everyone. We will see you all next. Oh boy.
Hi, Drew. hey, so we're Rob. Back on the mics.
Danny made a joke. It was a joke.
He said, yeah, you just heard it. For us, it was an even longer time ago because we recorded a couple hours ago. But Danny made a joke that until we saw something on Piastri's social media account about the Alpine announcement, you know, maybe we couldn't really trust it. Cut to... just a few minutes ago, at Oscar Piastri on Twitter, I understand that without my agreement, Alpine F1 have put out a press release late this afternoon that I'm driving for them next year. This is wrong, and I have not signed a contract with Alpine for 2023. I will not be driving for Alpine next year.
Oh boy.
Dude, we are in the driver empowerment era. This is the demand to be traded age of open wheel racing. And I don't know if it all goes through, right? Like if this stuff all goes to court, again, like I could see team principals and just teams not wanting to get muscled like this on contracts, but by definition, these are rare talents. So, like, it's difficult to just be like, hell with it, we're going to force you to honor this contract. I'm floored. I really thought that surely after the Pelot situation, we all saw that play out, Alpine would not try the force the driver's hand and do the announcement based on the fact that, hey, we already have a contract in place.
Yeah, I just... Does this immediately mean that he has signed for McLaren? Like, I mean, what else could that mean?
That was the rumor. It almost has to be. That almost has to be... Though, here's the weird thing. Why would you fight that hard to get into McLaren right now? Like, I just don't know that... I do not know that I would be, like, ready to... burn a bunch of bridges to get out of Alpine into McLaren right now. It really seems like not a frying pan fire situation because they're both like neither's in a terrible place, but like equivalent mid-pack teams really and equivalent prospects. But it could be, you know, part of the Pelot situation was there was money on the table that he felt like, you know, he felt he came in undervalued under the Ganassi contract. I do wonder if Piastri, feels like the sort of development contract and reserve driver contract he signed with Alpine coming out of the juniors program is not the contract he wants to sign as one of the most in-demand rookies for 2023.
Yeah, could be. I mean, Alpine is currently ahead in the constructor standings by 4 points. But, you know, I also don't know what goes on. Like, what does the deck look like when the team is pitching the driver?
That's a good point too. McLaren is probably the better. It is the better brand. It's the more storied team. Sure. Alpine is sort of a mark that's being dusted off by Renault, but it doesn't in F1. It doesn't really have any cachet, and also, I mean, I suppose if you're Piastri, you're also looking at things have kind of flipped now where these first contracts are so important for drivers because they're kind of career defining. You know, mm-hmm. kind of like a lot of drivers come up through this model of slowly filtering. Like you filter in F1 at the back of the pack, and then you filter up to one of the leading teams, and then you have your like main career, and that's sort of where you establish yourself. But I think it's sort of clear now with I suppose Russell is following that tradition, but you'd also say we don't know how that's going to play out, whether or not some good years were lost there. But in the meantime, Max was never allowed out of Red Bull's sight. Max always sort of had a red carpet, heading toward F1 that was only briefly delayed by, I guess, Danny Kvyat. And then Lando Norris, looks like he's really well situated at McLaren. Though, again, I don't know why you fight to get into McLaren to go up against their boy. He feels like entrenched. And then Ferrari, of course, gave Leclerc the keys to the kingdom as he came in. So I do suppose that Piastri is also seeing a landscape where you want to start strong. And that is, you know, that these first contracts are a way that you can give yourself a lot of runway in F1 with a top team and a contract that shows they have confidence in you and gives you some breathing space. But I did not think we would see this get blown up this way.
No, I mean, this proves to, be a nice news story to follow throughout the whole summer break. I am imagining the Palou stuff has not been decided. Like that is still ongoing. Legal proceedings take a while. Do we see Ricardo go back to Alpine if Piastri goes to McLaren?
I feel like I saw some people floating that around as the like. You know, I mean, you hear everything sort of is theorized about once silly season is in full swing. So I think I saw some of that where some people suggested that between Piastri and Ricardo, there might be a position swap. I don't know that, it's clear, like 2 years ago, Ricardo should not have made that switch. He should have stuck with Renault. He was in a much more comfortable situation there. That is no longer the case. He is, he's now facing the possible loss of his seat. And I just don't know that. I don't know that the door is still open to retreat back across it. Like, I suppose this screws Alpine. Like, Alpine are bent on doing this because at the start of last week, they were anticipating re-signing Alonso. And they were trying to figure out how we keep Piastri on the hook. Now, Tuesday, August 2nd, they have neither of these drivers potentially. And so now they've got a seat. And I'm not sure they have a ton of great options for filling it.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of this like from Ricardo's perspective. At Renault, the team wasn't shining, but he was like still in relatively high regard. I think even though arguably the McLaren is a better car, he has tarnished his own kind of reputation. So I think going back to Alpine would be great for him. Especially if he can like hang or be better with, Ocon. But I don't see if like Ricardo gets the boot and it's not at Alpine, I don't know what happens. I don't know where he goes.
No, because the only stops left are at like much reduced teams. Like maybe you're in the running for the Latifi seat sweepstakes, which appears that's going to be pretty much a done deal. But like, I think Elizabeth Blackstock, don't know if she wrote an article about that. I think she might have. I know that she tweeted about it. I feel like she might have written something at Jalopnik, but basically arguing that Ricardo, if there's anything in his future, it's probably sports car racing or like not, they're not prototype cars anymore. They're we're in the hypercar era, but like that would be more where he goes, because that is a place where you can still get, if you're a good F1 driver, you can still get like a top flight drive at some of these operations. And that would make more sense for him than continuing to sort of slide down the grid, into less and less competitive teams. And apparently, per Blackstock, like he is on record as saying like he doesn't view IndyCar as an option because he has no experience oval racing and is like IndyCar is not the place to learn to do that. So his options are rapidly narrowing here. If this Piastri tweet indicates that there is something, like signed and sealed between him and McLaren.
Yeah. Well, to get him oval experience, I think there's only one option and it's the trucks. Get Ricardo in a camping world truck.
They lose the camping this year, but they get Ricardo next year. So their notoriety explodes. Who knows now? This is the last little addendum we're going to be able to get done for this pod. The first part of the story broke while we were recording. Then this drops a couple hours later. Who knows what the driver landscape looks like by the time we record next? But this is, it feels like just the nature of silly season in open wheel racing is now profoundly different than I've ever seen it.
Yeah, for sure. In this employees market. Well, thank you for alerting me, Rob, with an all caps message over Discord. It's where I get all my F1 news.
Yep.
Yeah. And thank you, everyone, for being with us this whole first half of the season. Stay tuned, I guess, on news websites, on Twitter. And when we come back, I'm sure we'll have some fun updates.
I'll just add, like we were talking in this episode about last year, we had a competitive championship duel the whole way through the season. But historically, as someone who's watched the sport for a long time, the most reliable like source of entertainment in F1 is the soap opera, and the pendulum is swinging back.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, we will see you all next time.